Okay, well, welcome again. I'm Lars Stixrud. Louise and I will sort of split up this first sort of introductory hour, and keeping in mind Barbara's sort of elephant of all four fields being very much a part of our attempt to understand this unique region of the Earth better, the transition zone. Louise and I will cover different aspects of it. We'll also divide things up in such a way that I'll sort of provide a brief sort of overview of this region and sort of a glimpse at some of the important problems that might remain, at least my view of what some of these might be. And Louise will focus a little more, I believe, on the next part of the program, which will be the workshop part of the program, to get you guys thinking about sort of what research questions might be addressed during that part of the program as well. So the indefinite article here, of course, is crucial. I'm sure that everybody here would give a slightly different introduction to the transition zone. I just wanted to give a brief overview of some of the basics and some of the big unknowns that I think still remain. So the transition zone was first defined seismologically. Jeffries, Bullen, Gutenberg, these guys noticed that the dependence of the seismic wave velocity on depth was unusually high. In other words, it's a very steep velocity gradient between the depths of about 400 and 800 kilometers or so. And they also realized that this very steep velocity gradient implied something very important about the composition and or the dynamics of this region, because there's the relationship between the density gradient and the seismic wave velocities was such that this layer had to be either inhomogeneous in bulk composition or phase, or had to be non-adiabatic. Well, let me back up for a second and sort of orient ourselves in terms of the interior of the Earth. Here's a cross-section. We're going from the surface down to the bottom of the mantle at 2890 kilometers depth. The transition zone is here in between 410 kilometers and 660 kilometers depth. So that's where we're focused. The pressures there range from 14 to 24 GPa. And while these numbers are pretty precisely known, mostly from seismology, these numbers are less precisely known, but I think we know something about them, and I'll get to how we know those. Something like 1800 K, 1500 C in the transition zone. Okay, what do we know about the composition of this region? Well, not nearly as much. And the simple reason for that is that drilling extends through about the thickness of this black line here, down to about 12 kilometers maximum. Magmatism brings up some samples from the interior, but almost all of these samples come from the upper 200 kilometers, not making it down to the transition zone. I'll come back to that in a minute. So what do we know? We do know something. We can start with one of these samples that magmatism brings up to the surface. This is an example. This is an upper mantle xenolith. The scale here is a few centimeters, I imagine. It came from something like 100 kilometers depth, roughly. And you see that there are several minerals in it. And we'll talk about sort of the basics of thermodynamics. This is one of the remarkable properties of the solid state, is that it organizes the elements into several distinct phases, each with very different properties. In this case, we have these red garnets. We have sort of yellow-green olivine. We have Granny Smith apple green, it's been described as, clinopyroxene, and the black is probably orthopyroxene, I'm guessing a little bit from this image. Anyway, so these are the basic mineral phases that we think make up most of the upper mantle, okay? Now, what we can imagine is taking this rock down in pressure, down into the transition zone, and look at what happens to these minerals. And one of the important properties of the Earth's interior is that the pressures are so large that many pressure-induced phase transformations occur as you go down in depth. And the transition zone is really defined by these phase transformations. This is just to put this in a slightly different context, that these high-pressure polymorphs are seen in other ways in the Earth. They are found also in meteorites. A high-pressure polymorph of olivine called ringwoodite shows up as the purple here. Of course, these meteorites experience very, very high pressures as they impact the Earth. And we're looking at high pressure in another way and sort of taking our rock down into the transition zone. This also reminds us something else about where our knowledge of the composition of Earth's interior comes from. Meteorites play a big role, especially chondritic meteorites, in our ideas about what the deep interior is made of. Okay, so here's what the mantle phases look like. Let's go back to our rock. Our rock will be situated somewhere around here between 100 and 200 kilometers depth. And we've got olivine, garnet, clinopyroxene, orthopyroxene. Okay, that was our xenolith. And now what we want to do is we want to increase the pressure. We want to take that rock down in depth into the transition zone. Here's the transition zone here, okay? And we want to see what happens to it. And it undergoes phase transformations. The olivine transforms to wadsleyite, then ringwoodite within the transition zone. The garnet dissolves into it, the pyroxenes. And we also get a few other things going on, a little bit of acumodoite, calcium perovskite at the very top here. And the bottom of the transition zone is defined as this transition to a very different assemblage consisting of perovskite and ferropericlase and the calcium perovskite. We'll come back to these again later. Yes? It's not a different phase. It's a component of the garnet. It's the silica-rich component of the garnet. Yeah. And it's all a single phase. Now, these phase transitions are important for several reasons, one of which is that they affect the structure of the Earth's interior. We'll look at that. Produce seismic discontinuities, discontinuous changes in seismic wave velocities. They are partly responsible for that elevated velocity gradient in the transition zone. They're also important for other ways, one of which is that they give us one of our best thermometers of the Earth's interior. These phase transitions here move around with temperature. And so by matching up the position of these phase transitions to the seismic discontinuities that we see in seismology, that's our thermometer. That can tell us what the temperature is at that depth and that depth. And that's one of our best thermometers of this part of the Earth. And that's partly what this red line is based on. The red line is an adiabat. The entropy is constant along that line, and it is defined by its value at the surface, which is called the potential temperature, 1600 K. The temperature profile shows another important aspect of these phase transitions. These phase transitions either release or absorb latent heat, and that causes the transition zone to be a bit hotter than average compared to the adiabat on either side of it. The temperature goes up by about 100 degrees in the transition zone because of this exchange of latent heat. These phase transitions also influence mantle dynamics. The reason they exchange latent heat is because the pressure of the phase transition depends on temperature, directly related to their influence on dynamics. Okay. So this is a comparison then of the velocity structure of that series of phase transitions that I just showed you compared to the seismology. I put depth on the vertical axis this time, and a couple of different seismological models in green and red, and a couple of different mineralogical models in black. And you can see that we've chosen the potential temperatures such that the 660 transition and the 410 transition agree between the mineralogical model and the seismological model. There's a lot of other stuff going on here. The mineralogical model and the seismological models don't look much like each other in the transition zone. There are lots of reasons for that. I think we'll explore some of the reasons for that here. But the point I want to make is that there's a lot of interesting stuff to be learned from this mismatch here, because phase transitions influence so many different aspects of what we're all interested in about the mantle. Just a hint at some of the other mysteries or interesting aspects of the relationship between phase transitions and the seismic structure of the mantle. This is a map of the topography on those two discontinuities. They move up and down depending on what the temperature is in the mantle at a given point. And these patterns make some sense in terms of what we think the dynamics of the mantle are, but there are also some mysterious features here too. We would expect these two maps to first order to be anti-correlated with each other. They're not. Why they're not might be because it's difficult to measure the topography in these discontinuities. Might also be because we're missing something in the mineralogy, in the composition I don't think the full answer is in yet. One hint that there might be other things going on comes from, this is just an example of several papers looking at the more detailed structure of these discontinuities from Armin Deuss and John Woodhouse. And this is some measure of the amount of seismic energy reflected from different depths in the mantle. And here we see the 410 and the 660. Okay, we expect that. But then they also see this thing at 520, as others have also, and a doubling of the 660. And this is not entirely unexpected based on the mineralogy, but it hints at sort of the additional richness that we have in the structure of the transition zone beyond just the 410 and the 660. As I mentioned, these phase transitions influence mantle dynamics. The phase transition at the 660 is endothermic, it turns out. And so what that means is that in a cold subducting slab, the transition to the high pressure phase is delayed. And it doesn't get to the high pressure phase until the slab is well into the lower mantle. What that means is that the slab is now lighter than its surroundings, and its descent is inhibited by this density contrast. So, phase transitions influence dynamics, and this is another way to see that, a more colorful way to see that, I suppose, from Paul Tackley and co-workers. And what they've done is a more or less complete fluid dynamical simulation of the mantle, the temperature field at the top, compositional field, they assume a mechanical mixture of Hartzbergite and basalt in this model, and a field of an isotope, helium isotopes here. And what you see is that the transition zone is having an influence on the dynamics. You can see it in the composition field. You can see it in the temperature field up there. It doesn't show up as well in the helium field here, although you can see some hints of discontinuities here at the transition zone as well. So the transition zone is having some important influence on these things. Well, this is as good a time as any to remind ourselves of how we don't really know that much about the composition of the transition zone. And I mentioned in the beginning that we don't apparently have any samples of the transition zone. But maybe that's not quite true. There are some more recent results that suggest that we might actually have samples from the transition zone. I think it's fair to say that these are still a bit controversial. These samples need to be analyzed further. But basically what we have here is a diamond with an inclusion in it. This inclusion is ferropericlase. Some of these inclusions contain more than one mineral, and based on those associations, people think that these come from either the transition zone or even the lower mantle. This is a garnet, which has these bright sort of patches in it, and the composition of these patches and their alignment tells us that these patches are pyroxene, which is exsolved from the garnet. This tells us that this garnet used to have all the pyroxenes dissolved into it, and as it came to the surface, they exsolved out, again, implying that this came from the transition zone. So, very exciting possibility, then, with, I think, a lot further analysis and further work, of actually having samples of the transition zone that we can make sense of. And then you think about this, samples from the transition zone, how did they get up here? How did they get to the surface? Well, probably magmatism, not only based on the association of the samples with their geological surroundings, but also on the plausibility of how do you get something to the surface, must mean that magma came from this part of the Earth. We usually think of magma genesis as being a very shallow process. Is it possible that magma came from depths as great as the transition zone? This is just one example of a thin section of a type of magma that might have come from the transition zone. These transition zone magmas may be restricted to the earlier parts of Earth's history, where the Earth overall was hotter and the potential temperature higher. Okay, so let's come back to the structure of the transition zone. Here's one view of the structure of the transition zone. This is a tomographic model of the transition zone showing lateral variations in shear wave velocity of plus or minus 4% or so. And we've all seen, I think, models like this at various depths in the Earth. And I think to first order, upper mantle structure looks a lot like geology, that is the continent-ocean difference plus half-space cooling. the lower mantle looks a lot like subduction history, then what does the transition zone look like? Something in between? It's not obvious how to interpret a map like this. If you look at North America, North America is really cold in the upper mantle, and we understand that in terms of some cratonic root beneath North America. But here in the transition zone, it's anomalously hot. It's one of the hottest places on Earth. Why? Why should that be? I think there are lots of features in here that will probably change with time as people learn how to construct demographic models of the transition zone better. But I think a lot of difficult to explain features will probably remain. Well, what contributes to that structure? What contributes to that heterogeneity? Well, lots of things. One of the things that we kind of saw in that slice from Paul Tackley's calculation is that the composition of the transition zone is not likely to be homogeneous. It could very well be heterogeneity. Physical properties depend on composition. The kind of phases you get and their proportions depend on composition. And major element heterogeneity is dynamically active and will influence dynamics as well. So it'll feed back into the dynamics. Phase transitions will contribute to heterogeneity because as you go across the transition zone at one depth and you go across a range of temperatures, the kind of phases you get and the proportions of the phases will change, and that increases the lateral variation in shear wave velocity tremendously compared to what you would get without any phase transformation. So it's like a factor of two change here in the transition zone just from the influence of phases. And so if we want to understand what that tomographic slice means, then we're faced with a really interesting problem of trying to understand how temperature varies laterally, how composition varies laterally, major element composition varies laterally, and then also how that might be connected to trace element and isotopic heterogeneity, and also how phase transformations vary laterally. This sort of brings up one other thing about the transition zone, which is really intriguing. And that is that a lot of the minerals that we find in the transition zone can take up a lot of water. They have a very high solubility for water. And this is an example of such a mineral. This is a hydrous ringwoodite seen actually through the diamond cell, one of the main ways that we use to learn about materials at these pressure temperature conditions. And it's actually been laser heated in a couple of spots, inducing the phase transformation that forms the 660 kilometer discontinuity. So in the brown spots are the lower mantle assemblage of perovskite and periclase, and then in blue we have the transition zone phase of ringwoodite. Anyway, this ringwoodite can take up weight percents of water. And wadsleyite also, the other major transition zone phase, also can take up weight percents of water. And so this really raises the question. Just because they can take up that much water doesn't mean they actually have that much water in the Earth, but it does raise the question of how much water is down there. Some people have estimated that there might be more water in the transition zone than there is in the oceans. How do we get at that? How do we get at that question? How do we try to address that? Where is the terrestrial hydrosphere? And if minerals at depth can hold a lot of water, have they in the past? How much have they held? How has it been distributed between upper mantle transition zone, lower mantle, other parts of the Earth? Has it changed with time? Fascinating questions, I think, all really prompted by the fact that we have now evidence of many phases that have a lot of water in them, not only the nominally anhydrous phases like ringwoodite, but also hydrous phases like the one pictured here. And this has led to people constructing cartoons like this, where the blue represents possible locations of water in the Earth's interior, going all the way from the surface ocean, in this case all the way to the core. Maybe there's some hydrogen in the core. I don't think we can rule out that possibility at present. He's really focused on subduction zones here as being a major carrier of water into the Earth's interior. Is that the major source of water in the Earth's interior, subduction? Or is it maybe left over from the Earth's accretion? I think these are very much open questions. This idea of water in the transition zone has led to other models that have been very influential. My guess is that we'll see this figure other times during the course of the tutorial and into the workshop. This was advanced by Dave Bercovici and Shun Kurato as a way of sort of trying to understand how you work in a very hydrated transition zone into the context of global geodynamics. There are some problems with this model that some people in this room have pointed out. For example, we all know that in a rising part of the mantle, once you start melting, it's very difficult to stop. The amount of melt just tends to increase and increase and increase. And instead, in their model, they have this melt layer really restricted to right at the 410 kilometer discontinuity. So I think it's fair to say that there are problems with this model, but it's at least one way of thinking about some of the issues that might be involved with trying to understand where water is in the deep interior. This is a view that I like a little bit better. This is from Justin Revenon and Sipkin, and what they found seismic evidence for is a low velocity layer sitting right on top of the 410, right on top of the transition zone. They have this low velocity layer, which they interpreted as being made of partial melt, maybe with some water in it, and they suggested that that water might have come from a subducting slab. It's a very different kind of view than the Bercovici and Kurato model. Let me just end with one other thing, and that is the origin of deep earthquakes. Deep earthquakes is another place where the transition zone really pops out at you. What this is the number of earthquakes per year plotted as a function of depth. And what you see in the shallower parts of the Earth is this exponential fall off of the number of earthquakes with increasing depth. And then the transition zone takes over, and you get this sort of secondary peak here with lots of earthquakes, and then they end suddenly at the bottom of the transition zone. No more earthquakes below the transition zone. I think we don't fully understand all the features of this plot. There are suggestions, of course, for how to explain this sort of distribution. This blob here is explained by some in terms of phase transformations, in this case olivine transforming to ringwoodite, bypassing lanthanide altogether, transforming directly to ringwoodite. And it's complicated because you need to delay that olivine transition way beyond its, you need to have olivine sink to way beyond its stability field in order to explain this huge distribution here, which might be plausible because subducting slabs are cold. Water might have something to do with it as well. Deep earthquakes in here, most of these deep earthquakes are also difficult to understand because, after all, we're well below the brittle ductal transition. And so how do you explain all these earthquakes where you don't really have brittle behavior anymore, you don't have faults anymore? Presumably, dehydration and brittlement is one explanation of that. So I think I'll end there with sort of a very brief summary of some of the mysteries and important questions that I think remain in this region of the Earth. Thanks. Should we go on? Sure. Yeah, if there are questions, we can. You can do that, or yes. Right. So I guess one place where that would show up would be in here. One of the interesting things about the bottom of the transition zone is that this phase transformation is a negative Clapeyron slope, but the Garnet-Toporowskite transition is a positive Clapeyron slope, and depending on the relative amounts of the olivine and the garnet components, you could get either sign of that Clapeyron slope in principle. And that would then have important implications for mantle dynamics. It's possible that, I don't show it here, but as you change the potential temperature, the relative proportions of these various phases can change as well, and new phases can come in. different Clapeyron slopes can come in. And so it's possible that, I mean, you can construct scenarios where plumes and slabs see different Clapeyron slopes at the 660. So there's all kinds of richness here. What I went over is the sort of standard view that if you start changing mantle composition or temperature, then very different scenarios can pop up. $1,600K plus or minus 100, say. And that's actually identical to the mantle potential temperature that you would infer from the genesis of Mohr. So there's a nice agreement between petrogenesis and the temperature of the transition zone. Yeah. Yes. Yes. That occurs at about 300 kilometers depth, and it is caused by that phase change. And
as far as I know, we don't have this current data of this with regards to capital of this.
We do actually. Yes, they're measured. Yeah, just last year. And seismologists, some seismic studies do find a discontinuity at around 300 kilometers depth, and this phase transition is, as far as I know, the best explanation of that. Yeah, the X discontinuity is what Revenant Jordan called it. Other questions? Okay, we'll come back to a lot of these issues, I think, more than once during this tutorial. Okay. Here's the mic. Well, it's for the recording.
My name's Louise Kellogg. I'm from UC Davis. So I'm actually going to. So Lars and I decided to split up this introductory lecture in the following way. So he gave you a little bit of an overview into the transition zone in case you're unfamiliar with it. And since this is a short course leading into a workshop and with overlap, one of the things, and you saw from Barbara's introduction that that last time, this was a very productive workshop in the sense that actually people started collaborating on projects and they got papers and proposals and so on written. So in order to do that again or have something like that happen, one thing that's important to do is basically start talking right away about what the questions are. And Stan Hart actually, I don't know, back there somewhere, over there, asked the people who are going to be here for the third week in particular to give him some ideas and collected some ideas, and I've took those ideas and put them into a little presentation here where I'm basically just going to pose these questions to you with the idea that as you go through the tutorials and as you go through the lectures and the tutorials in the afternoons while you're developing this sort of hands-on toolbox, I'd like you to start thinking about these questions and thinking about how you might address them, and maybe you'll find that you have some ideas about them. And then at the end, I'm going to ask you, because I'm sure they're not all the questions are not on here, so I'm going to ask you to come up with some questions of your own as well. So basically, you've seen, this is a set of cartoons, and you'll see many different cartoons with many different color schemes that try and basically assemble some of the information that we get from the various different disciplines into a sort of visual hypothesis, you might say. And so these are sort of four of those possible hypotheses for how the mantle works, with the top of being slabs ending in the transition zone where the earthquakes stop. That's sort of historically, the fact that the earthquakes ended 670 led people to think that perhaps subducted slabs stopped there as well. But as we've gotten more information from seismology, it appears that slabs do indeed penetrate into the lower mantle, but they maybe have some complexity to their structure as they go into the lower mantle. And so this is the kind of thing that we're interested in understanding a little bit. So one of the questions that was almost universally asked was a variant of this: at what rate does material move through the transition zone? And depending on whether the person asking the question is interested in mantle plumes or in subduction zones, they might ask it in two different ways. They might say, well, what happens to slabs as they come down through the transition zone? So this is a figure that from Steve Brand's famous model. You've probably seen it, the various cross-sections through the Americas with the seismic velocity illustrated in these various cross-sections. And what you're seeing in the blue there is the structure of the slab as it penetrates into the mantle. And this area is the region that we're concentrating on in this workshop, the transition zone. So what happens there? Do the slabs go straight through? How do they bend? What do they do in different locations? What is the dynamics of these? So what rate does material move through the transition zone, and how does this compare to other rates in the mantle? So for instance, if you're interested in plumes, how does the rate at which material rises through the transition zone compare to the rate at which material rises off the thermal boundary layer at the core mantle boundary? That'll tell us a little bit about the overall dynamics of upwellings in the mantle. And so you might ask, is the transport of material across the transition zone maximum in some places? Is there a minimum place? Can we identify these places? These are very, very open-ended types of questions that one might ask. It's not necessarily clear exactly which tools you would apply to ask those, but you probably have to use the multiple approaches to the elephant to get answers to these. So a related question is, to what extent do the slabs pond in the transition zone? And maybe you get a sort of hint of this. You can kind of get a hint of this perhaps in some of these locations where the slab is a little bit narrow there and then kind of thickens up a little bit. So to what extent is it pond in the transition zone? And that can be addressed by a variety of means, one of which is dynamical models, either of the laboratory sort or of the dynamical or the computational sort. This doesn't address the ponding issue. It addresses a little bit the second question. So this is a picture from an experiment done at Australian National University of it's a tank with syrup in it, and it's meant to represent a model of a slab coming into a region. They can't put a full phase transition in these, obviously. So they try, in these experiments, people try and represent the change in properties by changes in viscosity, for example, in the lower layer. And they're looking at the change in dip angle of the slab and trying to see what happens. And what you can see is that this material coming down here essentially starts to lay out across in the transition zone, in this model transition zone. It spreads out in a kind of interesting way. So we're interested in how the changes in physical properties as we move into the lower mantle affect the dynamics of material crossing across the transition zone. And so, for example, this particular paper by McNamara was interested in the development of anisotropy in the lower mantle due to the change in properties of material as it crosses the transition zone. So another question along these lines is, do the subducted crust, which is welded to the rest of the lithosphere, and the rest of the lithosphere travel as a single package through the mantle? Or is there any possibility, I don't have a picture to illustrate this, but is there any possibility that the crust is basically scraped off somewhere along the line? and then store it somewhere. And that's a very interesting open question. And then you have to ask the question, how would you begin to address that? For example, would there be any geochemical consequences of such a scraping off of crust or not? And would there be some dynamical predictions that one could make? And what would those be? And then how would we test them? So, something to think about. Another thing to think about, Lars already mentioned this, so I won't really dwell on this, but he talked about the topography on the transition zone boundary. And a question is, exactly what is it that's generating that topography? And can we use that topography to test for some of these other questions, to test, for example, the presence of water, the presence of compositional differences in the transition zone versus thermal contributions to the transition zone? So can we use that? How much topography is there? Where is it? And what generates it? And then can we use that to test some of these other questions? Okay. Lewis, is there evidence for melt? Again, this is something that Lars mentioned already. And here's a paper. So Mark Hirschman is here and can answer questions about this figure, if there are any. So this essentially talks a little bit about possible sources of melting and where they might be, and how the subducted slabs interact with the transition zone and how that might influence where melting ought to be. There have been studies done that can give us information from the surface. This is a diagram from the drilling project in Hawaii that's been a comprehensive study of basically the Hawaiian volcano. And let's see if I can explain this. So it's combined with a rather simple dynamical model, actually, to try and determine where there is melting, where there isn't melting. And so the sort of bullseye pattern corresponds to some estimate of the melt supply, the maximum melt supply. There's an age line along there corresponding to the motion of the plate over the top of Hawaii. And that's basically an outline of the island of Kilauea there, and there's Lauihi on the edge there. So so there's some interesting, intriguing questions and perhaps some new recent data that we can use to get at some of those questions. Okay, so again, the role of water becomes an interesting question. As Lars mentioned, the mantle has the capacity to hold a lot of water, but that doesn't mean it has to have water in it. And it doesn't mean it has to have as much water as it can possibly hold. And so the role of water is very important. And then, this is kind of a somewhat related question, does the transition zone, as a result of any of these processes, have different characteristics near subduction zones or far away from subduction zones? Yeah. Sure. It is, yes, in a sense it is, that's right. As I understand it, it is. So it's meant to represent a single model of the possible zone of melting. That's 20, that is 20 kilometers, so yeah, sounds about right. Going down to extremely small, that's the point. 001. This is from Paolo and others. I'm not sure who the first author is on this, but thank you. Okay. Plumes, so I'll show you a figure on the next slide. Can plumes be tomographically imaged? And this is the classic picture of a plume that we have is an upwelling that emerges from a boundary layer instability, and in the spherical geometry that classically tends to be a rather narrow pipe-like upwelling and therefore difficult to image tomographically. And nevertheless, there are studies that purport to be able to image plumes through the transition zone and even into the lower mantle. And so the question is, what is the nature of those images and what are they telling us? It's very similar to the question we have about subducted slabs and what those images are telling us about the dynamics, exactly. Is there a change in the tomographic signature? And this presumes that for question one has an answer of yes. And then can we use some of the observations, such as the Hawaiian drilling project, to tell us about how the plumes behave in the transition zone. So here is a sort of cartoon and a data, I guess. So this is basically a series of slices, again, under Hawaii, published by, this is from LA, there's other people on this as well, published by the Princeton group. And there's Hawaii there. So what you're seeing is a series of slices through depth, and the yellowish, reddish color is the warm, is presumably, the, well, it's the slow material, so presumably the warm material. And that's basically penetrating all the way down. They see this going all the way down to the core mantle boundary. And so that's an image that purports to show the slab originating from the core mantle boundary and coming up. This is rather controversial, however. And so we probably, I won't go into this in any depth at all, but we will hear more about this sort of thing and how one would go about assessing a model like this and creating a model like this and then understanding what it means. So because plumes are of such interest, there have been a variety of attempts to understand them, and this is from Cordio and others, and they made an effort to categorize the hotspots of the world in terms of what their plume dynamics might be. And by basically the circles here, each one corresponds essentially to a hotspot, and the size of the circles essentially corresponds to a different kind of category of hotspot. So there's two of these big ones, which correspond to structures that have been observed in a variety of seismic models in the lower mantle, one under Africa, one under the Pacific. And those are drawn in this cartoon cross-section as these large blobs. And in this particular case, they draw little tiny plumes coming off of the top of the blobs. Okay. So the question is this dynamically feasible or not? And if it is dynamically feasible, what would it look like seismically? What would be its compositional, what would be its dynamical consequences for the mantle? What would this mean for our understanding of the mantle? They draw a secondary category of plume, which is a little bit more of the classic plume structure, which goes all the way from the core mantle boundary to the top in a narrow kind of way. And so, it seems like it's slightly out of focus, the projector, but that's Reunion Island, for example. There are several of these, and they're represented by these red spots on the map. And then, so that's basically attempting to try and understand some of the large-scale observations. I just did a blow-up of this because I wasn't sure you'd be able to see it that well. Okay, so Hawaii is one of these narrow pipe-like plumes in this model, and the other hotspots in the Pacific would emerge from the top of a larger upwelling. I think this cartoon was inspired by observations like this. This is from Barbara Romanovich and Charles Megan and the Barbara Romanovich group, and in which you can see that under Africa, and here's the map with Africa, and here's a couple of cross-sections. Maybe you can see that. There's one of the cross-sections, and there's the other cross-section running down there. A is this one. B is this one, in which you can see this very, very large, prominent structure in the lower mantle that represents a significant change in the shear wave velocity, and it's a very interesting dynamical structure. From the point of view of a pure just fluid dynamics point of view, if this were simply a hot material, it would be a big whopping anomaly that would be coming up very rapidly and would really be quite fearsome from a dynamical point of view. So likely it's being stabilized in some way, in my opinion, by some compositional variations which are helping to anchor it to the lower mantle. Nevertheless, there's some connection, perhaps, between this large structure in the lower mantle and the surface, and that's what inspired those things there. So we'll ask the question, is that realistic or not? And how would we go about answering the question of how those models are tied to observations at the surface? Okay, so the potential temperature question, again, Lars already mentioned this. And we might ask ourselves, actually, there now, we're going to hear in one of the tutorials, today or tomorrow? No, not today, tomorrow, one of the early tutorials, we're going to learn about some of the available databases. So one of the things that's nice about about working in this field today is that there are people who have dedicated a lot of energy and time to taking the vast array of published data and building large databases that you can then tap into very quickly, and it allows us to test models very rapidly, extract data very quickly. And so that enables us to do work that was much more difficult to do before. So you'll hear a little bit about that. And so it would be interesting to see if we can then use some of this information that's available from decades of publication to constrain some of the constraints and things like potential temperature. And then we'd also like to know, for example, are there correlations of hotspots with other information, again, such as the topographic information, such as geochemical information, dynamical information. And I've just put on here as an illustration of this a calculation that was provided by Cynthia Parmitani of a high-resolution numerical model of a mantle plume. And there are, so that since this is hot rising, this is a classical plume structure with an excess temperature. Oops, turn on the right back here. Clips, but it goes up to, that's 250 degrees there. Just gives you a sense of the scale of the temperature in this case, compared to a background mantle temperature, which is just referenced to zero. And so the plume is very hot. This white line covers the region where there may be partial melting available. And so you can see that that perhaps corresponds to that zone of partial melting that we saw from the Hawaii model. In fact, that Hawaii figure was done via a similar type of model. In this particular case, they've introduced these people have introduced tracers into this, and so these black streaks are actually streaks of particles that travel with the flow. So if we were working in a laboratory tank experiment, we might inject some dye or inject some reflective particles and then use various imaging techniques to see them, and they've done that essentially with these particles, and so one can see that essentially the source, these originate in the source way off the bottom of the page, but they come up and they get mixed around, and you get some very complicated structures here. And so if those are, if those could be associated with some kind of compositional signature, pick your favorite, then you could use these sorts of models to get at some of the geochemical consequences of mantle plumes. Okay, so one of the questions that came in to this sort of survey of interesting questions had to do with how the transition zone relates to structures in the lower mantle. So you've already seen one structure in the lower mantle under Africa, and it's been proposed that perhaps there's a lot of structure in the lower mantle, perhaps something like a layer or blobs or dome-like structures in the lower mantle. And I already mentioned that these are likely to be chemically different from the overlying mantle and therefore sort of sloshing around in a way that's sort of illustrated by this cartoon. So how does that affect our understanding of the transition zone? And in particular, how do such thermochemical mantle models, I'll give an entire talk later in the tutorial about thermochemical convection, which will explain the dynamics of all this stuff. But what are the effects of this on surface observations? And in particular, someone asked the question of how we can reconcile structure in the deep mantle and perhaps also structure in the transition zone with observations of the long wavelength geoid. And also a related question is that there have been earlier models that were very, very successful that considered only thermal anomalies, and how do we reconcile that with models that include compositional heterogeneity? And just for an illustration, I showed this is a gravity model taken from the GRACE gravity recovery and climate experiment, which is measuring the Earth's gravitational fields at high resolution. And this was their first sort of product, which was basically a gravity model. And it's exaggerated as topography is the way they presented it here, highs and lows in the gravity. Okay, I just wanted to say a couple more words about such large-scale structures in the lower mantle. And again, link it to experiments, just for fun. Again, here are some experiments. This was done by Andavai, and again, these are tank images of experiments done in a tank. These were very carefully and elegantly done experiments of two-layer convection, in which the layers are dyed. One of them is dyed blue, and the other one's clear. And so you can kind of see the difference. There's a little bit of mixing going on here. But the figure I'd like you to look at is this lower one, where you have these blobs that rise up. She sees, under the right circumstances, she sees oscillating blobby-like structures that persist for quite a long period of time. And what she determined was that actually the viscosity of the lower layer relative to the upper layer was the important was one of the most important parameters in determining whether you get complete overturn of the layer or whether you get a persistent layer over time. And she represented that. The other thing that's important, the other parameter that's most important, is what's called the buoyancy ratio, which is the relative density of this lower layer and the upper layer. And so that's plotted on this sort of plot. A series of experiments are plotted, and she sorted them out. The black dots are devised experiments. She plotted them out and categorized them as stratified hybrid, which is this kind of mixed structure, and then domes, which is this sort of structure, and then there's a regime where you just get complete overturn and the two fluids mix together very rapidly. And then there's some theory that goes into creating these lines. These experiments agree very well with the theory, which is nice. Now, a number of people have done numerical calculations to try and understand this phenomenon as well, and a couple of years ago I went and figure out what the range of experiment had been done. And so the colored dots are basically the range of experiments that I found maybe 2 years ago, as of about 2 years ago, that had been published. And they fall more or less into this category. And again, hybrid, stratified, doming. They actually agree. The experiments are never exactly the same as nobody's really attempted to do an experiment, a numerical calculation that exactly replicates these experiments, to my knowledge anyway. I'd be interested to add it to this if someone has. But to the extent that they are similar, the experiments and the numerical models, they agree quite well in terms of their categorization of the role of the viscosity contrast and the role of the buoyancy contrast. So that means that we're really starting to understand in a fundamental way what the dynamics of multiple component convection is. What we don't have as good constraints on is exactly what the proper range of materials is in the Earth. And so where would we put the Earth on this sort of plot is much more of an open question. And that's what we really would like to know the answer to. Okay, something we started last time, and we'd like to continue, is to understand the nature of mixing in the mantle and to understand whether mantle heterogeneity, what kind of structure mantle heterogeneity has. And in particular, is the heterogeneity in the mantle, does it have a sort of fractal kind of component to it? In other words, does it have a scale invariance to it? And we tested some of this with some numerical models where we looked at the evolution of we looked at published tracer models and looked at whether they appear to be fractal. And they did appear to be fractal in a large number of cases. And so we'd like to know whether this really holds generally. And if so, are there different characteristics of mixing or of the distribution of heterogeneities in the upper mantle and the lower mantle above the transition and below the transition zone? And so just to illustrate this, here are two calculations done 20 years apart, more than 20 years apart. Hoffman and McKenzie in the 1970s were one of the first to really look at this kind of problem. And what you're seeing is the evolution of a die in a numerical model, a very simple numerical model. And you can see it stretching, thinning, folding. This is the classic mixing kind of process, where you have stretching, folding. And it develops a series of tendrils, some of which are very, very thin, and some of which are much larger, blobby kind of structures. And it turns out one can associate a fractal dimension with it. And then more recently, many other groups have studied this problem since Hoffman and McKenzie did. And this is a model done by a student of mine, Donna Hunt, who introduced tracer particles. There are the tracer particles right there. starting there. They all end up spread out there over the course of a period of time in this series of snapshots. So this is a more realistic model in the sense that it does a better job of capturing of its higher resolution, its higher Rayleigh number. It's got a lot more of the dynamics in it that we'd like to see. And basically, you can see, again, this development of tendrils and thin, good distribution sort of globally of this original cluster of tracer particles, but the development of clusters and also a lot of very nice structure, thin filaments and so on that are scattered throughout the mantle and which may lead to some things that we could observe either through geochemistry or through seismology. So why was that problem even posed, you might ask? Well, the reason it was posed is because there is a strong evidence for heterogeneity at multiple scales in the mantle. And so this is just two scales. I could actually extend this a little beyond this scale, but this is a sort of global scale. This is just a histogram of the distribution of one isotope tracer that you'll hear about, helium-3, helium-4, in the mantle, as represented by its appearance in ocean islands around the world. And you can see that there is globally a range of values here, which suggests that there is a global scale of the distribution of mantle heterogeneity that we have to pay attention to. At the same time, locally, there is also heterogeneity. So this is these are two maps of let's just look at this one for the moment, of strontium 87-86 from the Galapagos Islands. So a study was done, multiple samples taken and analyzed, and there's small scale variation here on the scale of an individual ocean island. So that would be represented by a small number of points on this, but it has a lot of heterogeneity at the small scale. And if you go down to even smaller and smaller scale, you'll see heterogeneity at mostly down to the finest scale that we can detect. So that's very interesting. Global scale to small scale heterogeneity occurs. At the same time, mid-ocean-rich basalts fall, they're probably a little wider than this, but they basically fall on a very narrow scale on this histogram relative to the oceanic islands. And so that also suggests that there's kind of overall some exchanges of material around the globe in these mantles, so it's more. So that's an interesting thing to explain. Okay, so there were some questions, and these were again gathered from a variety of people who will be at this workshop at one point or another. And I'm not going to say that those are all the questions that we might be interested in. So what I'd like to do is basically end just by opening it up for a minute or two if we have time, or do you want, okay, if we have time, so to ask if there's anything I should add to the list that we want to basically focus on. Or if there are any things you say, wait a minute, you missed this big important point. We need to know more about this, that, or the other thing. So, take it away. I'm all stunned. Overwhelmed by the by the amount of information that we have already. Yeah.
I think it's a more narrow question.
Yeah.
I think from the
mm-hmm.
and composite materials and water and geologies of the lower mantle as well as geologies of the Big Diamond mm-hmm. and SHA would help us a lot in constraining this model.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more specific thing, but it's also something that we could talk about collectively.
I'm actually glad you've asked a more specific question, because I think if we're going to make progress on such questions, we actually have to be fairly specific. And these are very open-ended. And basically one could base a career on almost any one of them. So it's important actually to be able to take from those and extract a more narrowly focused question. That's a very good question. I don't have an answer to that. Maybe somebody else does.